It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of deadly encounters between police and civilians in Wisconsin is on the rise, according to an analysis from Wisconsin Watch.
The state had previously been among the lowest in the nation in fatal police encounters, but over the past 2 years, Wisconsin is outpacing some of its neighboring states.
The reporting from Wisconsin Watch found gaps in oversight and accountability in some of these cases, which aren't always accurately tracked in state and federal databases.
Jacob Resnick is an investigative reporter. He reported on fatal police encounters in Wisconsin for his last story with Wisconsin Watch. Jacob, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Can you put into context for us where Wisconsin stands when it comes to these deadly police encounters? We'll get into how we define these in just a couple of minutes.
Well, Wisconsin, if you look at like the national rankings, it's still below per capita, you know, some of the higher states like, you know, Texas or states which have a lot of deadly police encounters, or states with really low populations like Wyoming and Alaska. But if you look at our neighbors and compare us to other states with comparable populations, Wisconsin is far and away the leader of in the northern Midwest, and including in this past couple of years, the state of Illinois. Numerically, Wisconsin has more fatal police encounters than Illinois, that has a state with twice the population. So that's something we started to kind of dig into.
And those numbers going up over the last couple of years, you found?
That's right.
What kind of numbers are we talking about? How common is this in the state?
Well, we are looking at right now in 2024, we're going to say at least 19. We say fatal police encounters, we're talking not just police shootings, but also when so-called non-fatal force is used. So there might be a taser, might be restraints, someone held prone for a period of time. Sometimes there are sedatives used. But when the person basically dies in the custody of law enforcement under the course of an arrest, we have about 19 this year so far. Last year is quite high. The modern record, though, I believe was 26 set in 2017. And what got us looking into it is the fact that we're on pace to exceed that record this year.
One thing that makes this tricky, Jacob, as I read your reporting on this, is different states, different law enforcement agencies, different district attorneys and whatever might have different definitions of some of the things we're talking about. The data itself is hard to track. Can you talk about some of the difficulties and what it takes to put this together?
Sure. I mean, tracking in custody deaths and arrest related deaths and all that, it's a challenge nationally, because you know law enforcement is predominantly local in this country. So you have, you know, thousands and thousands of law enforcement agencies who have to report this stuff. Wisconsin is no different. There's been last 20 odd years, there's been federal tracking requirements, but there's only been state tracking requirements since about 2021. And even so, the State Department of Justice relies on individual agencies. So we found different incidents, different agencies would respond to different, report different incidents differently. So you might have a sheriff's department and a city police agency, or two of them all in one call, and they'll all report it differently and will all end up in a state database. So one might say it's an arrest-related death. One might say it's a use of force death. One might not even report it at all. And the DOJ, they are following the state statute. They just put the data all in. They throw it all in there. So when you're trying to look over our overall and see how many actually deaths you had in a year, it's really problematic to comb through it. And that begged the question of, if no one's actually coming through and looking at these, how are we going to find trends and find, you know, what are the lessons learned and what might actually be happening here in the state?
Some years back, Wisconsin passed a law that says when there is a police-involved shooting, right, a discharge of firearms, there would be an investigation, and it had to be by not that particular police department. It had to be some kind of other neighboring agency or state agency, what have you. It sounds like from your reporting with in-custody deaths where there isn't a shooting, there isn't anything like that. It might not be investigated at all. It might be investigated. What kind of things did you see there?
Well, if there is a use of force death, it's true. There is a law that requires another police agency. Usually, it's a neighboring police agency, or it'll be state investigators will do the investigation. But even though that investigation is done by another law enforcement agency, almost in all cases, the call to do whether that actual use of force was legal or lawful, that goes to the local district attorney. And we talked to some prosecutors who said that actually puts district attorneys in kind of a difficult situation because prosecutors rely on police to bring them evidence and cases to make prosecutions. And there's this really important symbiosis, and that's okay. But if you're also requiring prosecutors to police the police, that kind of puts them in an uncomfortable situation. So it's almost not surprising that in Wisconsin, in pretty much almost every case we could find, except the Civil Smith incident in Milwaukee in 2016, prosecutors are ruling use of force is lawful. And there's been some calls for maybe asking a special state unit or something to make that legal call. But right now, basically, DAs are clearing every use of force death, even ones where there are some clear questions we found if proper protocols and procedures were found. And what basically ends up happening is when the DA clears a use of force death that was questionable, it ends up going to a civil lawsuit. So the only recourse the families of the people have is usually to sue in civil court.
I kept thinking about in our neighboring state, the George Floyd death. The initial police report there said, it was a medical event. If it hadn't been for a video, that might never have been even reported as or investigated as a use of force by the police. That hypothetically could happen here in Wisconsin. A death like that, if nobody says use of force was involved, it might not lead to another investigation. Do I have that right?
That's right. And we actually did find a case where there was an agitated murder suspect the police responded to in Kokona last year. And he died under the course of his arrest. It was reported as a medical episode in the public release by the police department. It was cleared by the DA. When we did get the body cam footage, though, we did found that the police officers had held him prone and sat on his back for up to 6 or so minutes. We showed that to some independent medical examiners, and they felt that actually the use of force probably had a lot to do with the man's death, and it basically the public statements undercut the causation of the response, which led to the man's death. But if you were just to read the press release and look at the database, it looks like he died from other reasons.
Talking to Jacob Resnick about his reporting for Wisconsin Watch on police fatalities while in police custody here in Wisconsin. Jacob, you talked to a lot of people about why those numbers have gone up, as you said, on pace to hit a record here in Wisconsin, a record I think nobody wants to hit. What kind of ideas did you hear about why that might be?
Well, there's no one like easy answer, but I think what it looks like the major theme that we found is the large in a way, most of these encounters do end up peacefully and no one gets hurt. But when does something does go ha does happen and police don't follow their training, they don't use the de-escalation or they are arguably too quick to use force, there isn't really any inbuilt accountability. Also, police training really, really emphasizes officer safety. So, we looked at a lot of videos where someone would produce a knife and they're still, 15, 20 paces away and they're walking towards a police officer and they're shot and killed. Now, it's legally justified because the person was armed with a deadly weapon. But, independent experts we showed some of these things too would question like, was that officer's life really in danger in that actual second? And also what led up to that? Because the overall emphasis is to reduce the threat if it's provided and also, to make sure that police stay safe at all times. It really there's a real emphasis to use overwhelming force. There are no warning shots that police are trained to shoot to kill, to shoot in the core. And as we have, since there is no real down, I mean, there's the downside of obviously if you're wounded or hurt in the course of your profession, but there's no real downside if you're use your force too quickly. That seems to be the overriding theme that's may might be feeding into this into this
And one thing that struck me in your reporting is that there were people calling for changes, both in the training you were just talking about and in our reporting and accounting for these incidents, Jacob. And in many cases, they were former police officers themselves leading these calls for reform. What kind of things did you hear from former police officers who might have been in these situations themselves?
Yeah, it feeds into basically the culture of using the tools. Like, you know, tasers have been around for a couple decades now, but relying on tools to neutralize a threat really quickly, not to have less of an emphasis on talking things down, less of an emphasis on getting into a physical fight. So there is this, you know, there's this concern from some former officers that, you know, there is a too quick to use fatal force when looking at a threat.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Jacob, what are you watching for next? I know you've moved on from Wisconsin Watch, but what would be the next step in covering this story? What a big open question is there?
I think the big open question will be to see whether the State Department of Justice and lawmakers actually take a strong look at these trends. There have been in the past legislative initiatives that would like create like a use of force review board, kind of like the National Transportation Safety Board, that may not maybe look at the legality of, you know, individual cases, but try to do lessons learned. Right now, it's up to individual agencies to look at each incident, but there's no one actually looking at the big picture in Wisconsin and tracking these trends and actually asking these hard questions of why and what we can do better to reverse this.
Jacob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Jacob Resnick is a former investigative reporter for Wisconsin Watch. He was with us today to share his work on rising numbers of fatal police encounters here in the state.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new Frontline documentary followed two Milwaukee families for over 30 years after factory shutdowns derailed their lives.
That's where we meet them in 1991, still dealing with the layoffs and still trying to figure out what was going to come next.
That's coming up on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. For over 30 years, producers of a new Frontline documentary followed two Milwaukee families who lost good-paying manufacturing jobs in the 1990s.
Over the decades, the Stanleys and the Newmans work hard but struggle to maintain stability. The documentary shows the effects of low-wage jobs on relationships, retirement, and the futures of the children in both families.
It's called Two American Families, 1991 to 2024. It's the fifth installment of the series, narrated by Bill Moyers. You can watch online at pbswisconsin.org. Tom Cachado and Kathleen Hughes are the producers and directors of Two American Families. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kathy, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Before we meet the two families that are the subject of this amazing, long-running documentary project, Kathy, can you set the scene for us a little bit? The economics, factories closing in Milwaukee, what led us into this story?
Yeah, well, factories were closing in Milwaukee. They were closing throughout the region that we now call the Rust Belt. And it was about 1990, and hundreds of thousands of people had already lost their jobs. And there was a lot of conversation about what was to come next for these folks. There was conversation about maybe people will work part-time and get more civically involved. Like, there was all kinds of speculation, and we got the assignment to figure that out.
Kathy set me up with a union representative who was representing Briggs & Stratton laid-off workers who were trying to get new jobs, trying to retrain, mostly at sea. I talked to about 80 laid off Briggs and Stratton workers in groups of approximately 20. And I just sat up in front of the room and I asked a question that the first producer of documentaries I ever worked for used to ask. And I learned it from him. If you were going to watch TV tonight and you knew your life was going to be the subject of a PBS documentary, what would you want to see expressed? What story would you want to tell? What myths would you want to be dispelled? And that's a great question to get people talking. They really start to tell their own stories. And a couple of people just really stood out as compelling. One of them was Tony Newman and one of them was Jackie Stanley. That's the dad in one of the families and the mom in one of the other families.
Kathy, can you introduce us to the two Milwaukee families at the center of the documentary, the Stanleys and the Newmans?
In the Stanley family, Jackie Stanley had been working on the line at Briggs and had been recently laid off when we met her. Her husband, Claude, about a year or two before that, had been at another big Milwaukee manufacturer, A.O. Smith. So they lived in Sherman. They still live in Sherman Park. But back then, a lot of people who lived in Sherman Park were able to support middle-class families with these kinds of jobs. They had relatively high wages, they had benefits, they had pensions, and suddenly that had all gone away. So for Jackie, at least, she decided she was going to work in real estate. I could go on and on about the Stanleys, but Tony Newman had also worked at Briggs, and he and his wife, Terry Newman, at that time, had three little kids. Tony had gotten the job in the late 80s. They thought it was a secure job. They bought a house. Terry had hoped to stay home and be a full-time mom to these little kids. And when we first met them, they were struggling. Tony had been laid off about a year before that, and they were really struggling to hold on to their house. So that's where we meet them in 1991.
Tom, over the last couple of decades, a story I kept hearing again and again was, you know, somebody who had that good-paying factory job, $18-$20 an hour, which was a lot, especially at the outset of this, then going to that service sector job where they're making $6-$8 an hour. These documentaries really put a face on that. Can you talk a little bit about how that impacted just the life of these two families for the next 30 years after you started?
I think there was an implicit promise, never written down, never stated, but that they would have a foothold in a good, decent American middle-class life. And all I really mean by that is being able to put food on the table, have a decent car to drive to get to work, work real hard, put your kids through school, and not have to go to bed every night wondering, how are we going to make it? How are we going to make it? For the Newmans and the Stanleys, the parents in each family, who have spent the last 34 years after we met them living in that service economy, they're kind of a lost generation as far as the American dream goes. We don't know what's going to happen to their kids. We can't write the future, and a lot of the kids are doing very well. But for them, they never really had the opportunity to make it, if you will. That doesn't mean they didn't in some ways make it. You know, if you look at the YouTube comments on this film, everyone is taken with how strong these families are, how hardworking they are. And of course, that's a real Milwaukee thing and Wisconsin thing, to be very hardworking people. I think about Jackie Stanley. She was laid off. She decided to go into real estate, where she was basically going to be working for herself or working for an agency, living off commissions. Talk about somebody who pulled herself up by her bootstraps. Talk about somebody who was never looking for a handout, even as her income was severely downgraded when she lost her jobs at Briggs and Stratton. She worked and has worked and continues to work so hard as a real estate agent, and she's good at it. Kathy and I have been able to observe her over the years. She's got the smarts, she's got the skills. One thing she doesn't have is that she's not white, and racism plays a part in this story. Jackie has always only been able to sell in communities where the homes are worth less. And as such, of course, her commissions are less.
I want to stay with the theme of hard work and give a listen to one of the Stanley's kids, Keith. He's a kid when we first meet him in the earliest part of the documentaries. Grown up now as a young kid, he starts a lawn care business to help the family get by. Eventually goes to college, starts working at City Hall, now a nonprofit leader in another state. Here's some of what he had to say about hard work and sacrifice.
I would say the key word that I think that's not spoken enough of is sacrifice in this country. We can point to a lot of indicators of how great the economy is. Our productivity over the past 40, 50 years in this country has skyrocketed, but there's a sacrifice to that. The sacrifice of not being home to see your kids go to school. The sacrifice of always putting work before everything else. I still believe in hard work, but I will say that I think we are fooling ourselves if we believe that it's only hard work.
Kathy, I want to follow up on these on this theme because very clearly these are people who want to work, both of these families, but circumstances really beyond their control have put them in this situation, which I think is what we heard Keith getting at there. Can you talk about that theme?
Hard work is the theme, and it's not only that they want to work, they do. Mm-hmm. Throughout the last 34 years, everyone has been working hard. That's just a given. And that's what I think amazes us every time we think about these folks and their lives, is that they're not sitting around saying, oh, give me a handout. Oh, you know, they're hoping and persevering and hoping things get better over time. And I think part of what is a little bit upsetting is that the struggles continue. The parents are now reaching retirement age and things are tight all around, and they are far from the only Americans who might not have enough tucked away for retirement as they reach retirement age.
Could I add something to what Kathy
said
about Keith? I remember the moment interviewing Keith when he said what he said in the quote that you just played about hard work. And this light just went off in my head, and it was like, wow, that is a lot of what this film is about. One of the pleasures of the film, I dare say, in watching it, is watching kids grow up. You meet Keith at the beginning of the film. He's about 15. Now he's in his 40s. And Keith is someone who recognizes that the success he has had in life could lead someone to believe that, gee, if you just work hard, everything is going to work out for you. And who cares about these external forces? And things have worked out in a good way for Keith, but he is so aware of everyone else around him in his community, but also in his country. And he knows that hard work isn't the only thing that allows you to make it.
We're talking about a new Frontline documentary featuring two Milwaukee families covering their lives in difficult economic circumstances over 30 years. Tom Cachato, Kathleen Hughes are with us, producers and directors of Two American Families. You can watch it right now at the PBS Wisconsin website. Let's look at the impact on the neighborhood now, because this isn't just these two families experiencing this. It's hitting everybody at once. So housing costs are going down. Everybody's competing for those same service sector jobs now. Tom, can you talk a little bit about what these families are watching as these factory closures affect not just them, but their neighbors too?
As far as what the families are witnessing right now, they're living through what most of America has been living through, which is wages are going up, but inflation has been very bad. Now, just recently, inflation appears to be ticking down, so we'll see what happens. But they've been in a situation, certainly in the Newman family, where they're making more money, but they also are not really getting ahead because it costs so much more money to live. In the case of the Stanleys, they've entered their 70s. They are in a state of, I would call it, semi-retirement. Claude retired from his job with the city of Milwaukee with a pension. Jackie is still doing real estate. Claude is still helping her out with that. They are not in a position to say, oh, wages are rising, that's a good thing, even though it doesn't keep up with inflation, because they don't get wages. They are in their 70s still working to keep going. I think that everybody who watches the film will witness people who've been through what America has been through. The American, call it the working class, at least.
The city of Milwaukee also changes through the documentary. Poverty increases, and so does violence. The Stanleys live in a neighborhood where they feel safe, but then eventually have gang members trying to recruit their kids. A son of the Newmans has a harrowing experience with neighborhood youth targeting him. I want to give a listen to the mom, Terry Newman.
People are getting angry. They're getting frustrated, they're getting violent, because they don't see no way out. There are so many people that are struggling the same way with the cost of everything and not getting enough on your paycheck to cover your monthly expenses. It's like we haven't come very far.
Kathy, Terry, they're making a direct line from the difficult economic circumstances in the communities that both families live in and crime and violence. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, she says it very well, and it's really what they have been observing. Her older son decides to have a handgun in order to protect himself. He just feels like that's what he needs now in order to feel safer. So it's, again, it's not just Milwaukee. I think this is becoming a problem in a lot of communities.
You know, when we first visited shooting in 1991, we filmed at the Newman's Church, and you'll see them in church over the years in the film, and you'll see their priest, Father Mike, over the years in the film. When I went back to Milwaukee to film in the 2012 installment of the film, there was a sign entering the church, absolutely no firearms allowed. Great sign. I think you do want no firearms in a church. But the fact is, in 1991, they didn't have to put that sign up. It wasn't an issue. By the time you get to 2012 and certainly to the present, there's just a lot more arms out there. And again, this is not solely about Milwaukee. This is about America in general. This is just one more thing that people have to deal with.
And the guns are complicated. Some of it are gun laws have changed as well. But to your point, it's very different.
I want to give a listen to another moment in the documentary here. We're, of course, in a presidential election year in 2024. This film spans six presidential administrations, and you have a montage at one point of incoming presidents promising new jobs in a prosperous middle class and solving a lot of the problems, or hoping to solve a lot of the problems these families are dealing with. I want to give a listen now to the Stanleys watching Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993.
This president, I think I can trust and relate to some.
Four more years, but you need to grow up a little bit.
Today we celebrate the mystery of American renewal.
Yeah, I've been there with Reagan, Bush, and now Clinton. I'm not saying I don't trust presidents. Is that you say a lot of stuff to get on top. Even if I was running for something, I'd be like, everybody get free candy and everything, you know. So you say a lot of stuff to get on top.
Kathy, there's been a lot of ink spilled, or digital ink spilled, about Rust Belt voters who may be in situations just like the Stanleys and Newmans, lost jobs, the factories have gone away, and what do they do with politics? How did you hear both families talking about big politics, big political issues over the years?
Well, I'll tell you, we consciously decided not to bring any retail politics into these conversations. We felt like it could bias people. It would change the nature of what it is we're looking at. So to some extent, as you'll see, we don't really ask anybody who they're voting for. That said, I feel like people are watching and listening, and but they also are very, very busy. And day in and day out, they're not necessarily paying attention to what's happening the way news junkies like we are.
You see six different presidents in the film: Bush, Clinton, the second Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden. And to me, the presidents in this film operate the way that the voices of adults operate in the Peanuts cartoon strip. If anybody out there is familiar
wah,
with
wah,
Peanuts,
wah, 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 wah.
Yeah.
Kids are talking to each other. Charlie Brown's talking, Lucy's talking, Snoopy's thinking to himself. And anytime an adult speaks, that you don't hear what they say, you just see these little lines in the speech bubble. It's like blah, 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 blah. And I think that is kind of how Washington talk operates in the lives of these families. They hear it, there's hope, there's less hope, they go back and forth. But really, what's happening in Washington isn't really affecting their lives.
Right. What's affecting their lives in so many ways are things like healthcare costs. We talked about inflation a couple minutes ago, and that's a big problem in the present. But over the decades, there's been a lot of other things that have become much more expensive, like housing, like healthcare, like education. Those are the kind of things that we wanted to make sure people understood. We wanted people to understand things are changing on those fronts.
And as we wrap up, Tom, can you talk about the value of coming back again and again, not just leaving at that first documentary, but seeing how this family has grown, has changed over the decades?
When Kathy and I first knew each other, we went to see Michael Apted's film 28 Up, part of the 7 Up series, which I'm sure folks are familiar with, where he interviewed 7-year-olds in Britain and went back when they were 14, when they were 21, when they were 28, 35, et cetera, and made an incredible documentary series. And we thought, gee, we'd like to do something like that someday, never suspecting that we would have a story like this that went on over the years. I think there's a lot of power in that, and that any documentary filmmaker who's made a film that they like with compelling people who the audience likes would love to have the opportunity to go back. And we've just been fortunate to be able to do so. And I think it really allows you to look at Jackie and Claude Stanley and Tony and Terry Newman as look at them generationally, not just at a moment in time, but to say, what has happened to these folks who grew up with an idea of what the American dream was and have now spent decades living in the absence of that dream? I think it just tells you a lot more about the country than we could ever tell in making an individual film.
We'll leave it there. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Kathy, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Tom Cachado and Kathleen Hughes are producers and directors of Two American Families. That's a new Frontline documentary that took place over 30 years following two Milwaukee families who struggled to stay out of poverty. You can watch it online. It's at pbswisconsin.org.
Up on Wisconsin Today, disc golf is gaining momentum with a new course in Green Bay and the National Women's Championship set for Manitowoc.
I find, you know, nothing better than a Sunday afternoon walking through the woods, hearing the birds chirp and the occasional changing of some chains as I'm playing my round.
Women players advancing disc golf, that's ahead on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about exploring the depths of space.
Photographers tend to spend a lot of time with their subjects. For astrophotographer Rick Wayne of Madison, his subject for much of his life has been space. What started off as an interest in taking better pictures soon became something much greater, a sense of glory. And on one clear night, Alexandra Salmon joined Wayne to take photographs of the night sky.
Okay, so this here is a tracking mount. It's an equatorial mount. This was 2 checks from Grandma Lynn's worth of money, and maybe a little contribution from my wife, too.
That's Rick Wayne, software engineer by day, amateur astrophotographer by night. We're at the Yana Astronomical Research Station in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, surrounded by crickets, owls, and a clearing in the trees with a perfect opening to the starry night.
Not to snow you with tech talk, but this is an 8-inch Ritchie Chrétien astrograph, which is to say it's a reflector telescope.
So with the images that you produce, is that what is actually out in space if we were to be space?
That is a terrific question. If you were out in space and looked at it, you would see nothing because these gases are a pretty good vacuum. But part of it is also because the camera is integrating. There are only a few photons hitting the sensor every second, and your eyes can only integrate about 1/4 of a second at a time. So the camera can do it for, you know, hours if I tell it. Technical reasons, you wouldn't do that. Something like the Andromeda Galaxy, which is just in an image with lots of integration time, it bursts with color and it's just gobsmackingly gorgeous. In most telescopes, it looks like, oh yeah, there's some fuzzy stuff and a couple of stars there. And that's what most of these deep space objects look to the eye. And it would be pretty much the same if you were out there in space, even close up looking at them. This part, this can here, is a thermoelectrically cooled monochrome astro camera, which means that it's just taking in photons. It doesn't care what color they are.
Mm-hmm.
This in front of it is a filter wheel. And if you look, you can see one of the filters there.
The images are obviously, I mean, they're so beautiful. And I wonder if you ever feel like looking up at space does something for you that looking around here on Earth doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's stuff going on up there. You don't get a sense of the forces at play in the universe and the really deep history. You can't see that on Earth. The old Carl Sagan saying that we're all stardust. You know, every atom in our bodies that is higher up the periodic table than iron was built in a supernova explosion, or else in the Big Bang. That's the only place those atoms come from. And yet here we are, you know, we're tiny little insignificant specks of matter. And yet that's our whole world is built out of stuff that came out of supernova explosions.
That's wild.
It is. And looking up there, you know, you get thoughts like that when you do it.
Alexandra Salmon is an independent radio producer who lives in Madison. She brought us that story on astrophotographer Rick Wayne. And what you're hearing now, sonifications of Hubble images converted into sound by NASA. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. It's Wisconsin Today.
The sport of disc golf is growing in Wisconsin and around the world. According to the Professional Disc Golf Association, more than 200,000 of its members play across 54 countries.
And now the UW Green Bay campus is getting into the game with a newly designed 18-hole course that features a mix of elevations, ravines, and water hazards on 700 acres.
So what goes into designing a disc golf course that attracts both avid players and newcomers to the sport?
Ethan Harvey is Outdoor Adventure Recreation Coordinator for UW Green Bay. Ethan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
And Lindsay Krause of Manitowoc is a nationally ranked player and director of Lakeshore Ladies Disc Golf Corporation. Lindsay, welcome.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Lindsay, starting with you, for people who are unfamiliar with the sport, how do you explain disc golf?
Yeah, I like to explain disc golf as an accessible and affordable sport. It's very similar to the sport of golf, very similar rules. You've got a driver, you'll have mid ranges and different, like you have multiple clubs, you have multiple discs for different shots. But the concept is similar. You start on a tee and you are trying to get to and in the basket in as few throws as you can.
Ethan, why build a disc golf course on the UW Green Bay campus?
Oh, wow. So many different answers to that question. And I suppose the short version is, like Lindsay said, it's accessible and it's affordable. And it's a fantastic way to utilize a beautiful piece of landscape that we had on our hands here. So we decided to put that in here, amongst other things, so that more people can come out and enjoy such a beautiful natural space.
Walk us through this course, what it's like, what are the features that you've created on these 18 holes?
Well, our designer, Kale LaVisca, has done a really fantastic job of creating a beautiful walk in the woods that involves disc golf, is kind of how we've thought about it. You start on hole one directly by the Shorewood Center building. And then from there, it's a series of, if you play from the long tees, it's strong arms and long throws, or you can play from the short tees for a slightly more or less robust experience. Some of my favorite features are the water hazard on holes four and five, especially five. There's a little tree window that you have to throw through. So this hole, and then 14, where it enters a low land, low elevation ravine by a creek, is just a particularly beautiful spot.
And Lindsay, you've checked out the course. What do you think?
Yeah, I am very excited about the opportunity. Kale is a wonderful course designer. He is one of the top course designers worldwide, and he's got some of the bigger name courses in the United States, the Preserve in Minnesota being one. So I'm excited to have his work of art, you know, right up the road here in Green Bay. And to be able to tap into that student population and engage them with the sport is extremely exciting. I'm really glad to have them, you know, here in the neighborhood.
What makes a quality course one that is both accessible for beginner players, but also really, you know, has a lot of features that may be harder for experienced players?
One of the features that Ethan touched on is distance. So, you know, our more experienced players are looking for that longer shot to be able to show off what they can do. But it's also great to have a lot of variety of shot, to have some short technical shots, some more wooded holes where you may be fighting against some trees to make your way down the fairway, also combined with some open holes. And players are looking for things like great wayfinding to make sure that the flow of the course makes sense. You aren't having to walk back up a fairway to get to the next tee pad and things like that. You know, benches, signage, things like that all also play a big difference in what is considered a good quality course.
We're talking about the sport of disc golf with Ethan Harvey there, Outdoor Adventure Recreation Coordinator at UW-Green Bay. And Lindsay Krause is here, head of the Lakeshore Ladies Disc Golf Corporation in Manitowoc. Lindsay, the Lakeshore Ladies mission is to create a welcoming and empowering environment for women to play disc golf. How do you go about working toward that mission?
Yeah, so we run leagues in both Manitowoc and Sheboygan County that are, one, free to play, and two, we're just constantly marketing and trying to let ladies know that even if you've never played before and you want to come, let me know ahead of time. I'll bring a bag of discs for you to try and to play without on the course. But we just want to be an environment where we support each other. Part of what I love about disc golf is, yes, you in tournament play are competing against other players, but you're always competing against yourself. You receive a rating for your rounds. Your rating averages and propagates over time. And so you're always thriving for self-improvement. So it's a great environment for us to lift each other up and support each other in enjoying the sport that we all love. And like Ethan mentioned, it's another excuse to be out in nature and doing physical activity. And, you know, it's all great things as we try to build just this community for women as an entity.
When were you introduced to disc golf? What was your on-ramp to the sport, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, I've been around disc golf living in Manitowoc. We have Silver Creek Park, which is one of the top 100 courses in the world. So I've always known of disc golf, but I picked up disc golf as a hobby after I finished my master's degree. I needed a hobby that wasn't work or school related for the first time in my life. So I found disc golf because it is accessible and affordable, and started playing with my husband and some friends, and quickly found that as a female, I felt pretty out of place. I was playing with only male counterparts out on the course, and that was what really drove me to say, build it and they will come. I found a love of the sport. I learned so much about myself and gaining confidence through the sport that I decided I'm just going to start leagues. I'm going to start competing around the state. I'm going to run a tournament. So now I run the only women's only tournament on the Wisconsin Disc Golf Tour, and continue to grow and try to bring more women into the sport, using that as a platform for building community.
Ethan, I would imagine this is a great outlet for students on the Green Bay campus for stress relief as well.
Absolutely. And that's one of the main parts of the university recreation, our department, our mission is not only physical well-being, but mental well-being, which you get from physical activity, mindfulness activities, and then for my part is spending time outside. And just being out in the sun and seeing the wildlife and seeing the beautiful wildflowers that the Arboretum folks have put in and just the flowing landscape is just, you really can't beat it.
Do you have to pick up any discs that accumulate in places that they shouldn't, or is that, or won't that be a problem?
Well, definitely not a problem. We're more than happy to do it. But since we opened this past Saturday on the 17th, we have four discs that we have already called people about. And then we have a disc drop behind hole one, which is basically a mail slot in the side of the building. And we have currently there are 6 discs in there that we still need to get the phone numbers off of and call people for.
Lindsay, how often do you practice?
My league is every week, so I'm playing with the other ladies every week, and then there's another league locally that I play every week, so at least twice a week, and then usually my husband and I will play 2 other rounds for fun throughout the course of the week, and then when I'm competing, I'm not competing a whole lot this year as we're planning the U.S. Women's Championship for next year, but typically when I'm competing, we're competing 3 of every 4 weeks of the month throughout the summer months. So that's a 2-round tournament usually, sometimes a 3-round tournament as well.
Wow. Okay. And you mentioned that the U.S. Women's Disc Golf Championships are coming to Manitowoc. Can you talk about hosting this event and what it means?
Yes, it's such a big undertaking. It's a little overwhelming. We're in the throes of it right now. But, it's going to be huge for our community. So the event in itself is going to bring over 350 competitors. This last year, they had competitors from 8 different countries. So it brings in all these big name professional players with their caddies, with their families that come to spectate. It's going to bring in spectators, camera crews, media. It's going to bring event staff. It's going to be pretty massive in terms of just the number of sheer bodies that it brings to Manitowoc County for this event. It's going to be live streamed on Disc Golf Network. You're going to see recaps of it on ESPN and post-production on YouTube. So we're going to be able to showcase our local disc golf to the world. And I'm really excited to be able to do that.
Well, Ethan and Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Ethan Harvey is Outdoor Adventure Recreation Coordinator for UW-Green Bay. And Lindsay Krause of Manitowoc is Club Director of the Lakeshore Ladies Disc Golf Corporation. She's working to organize the U.S. Women's Disc Golf Championships that will take place in Manitowoc next year, attracting hundreds of competitors. And we've been talking about the growth of disc golf in Wisconsin and a new 18-hole course set on the UW-Green Bay campus. If you play disc golf, let us know about your game and where you play. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. In coming days, we'll learn about a church in Wisconsin that brought a nurse on board to help meet the health needs of its congregation.
And we want to hear from you. Are you part of a spiritual or religious community? What does it mean for you? Does it do things beyond its religious mission, like checking in on the healthcare needs of members, outreach and mission work, providing a social connection?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call or text us. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. We look forward to hearing from you.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.